in where Jesus plainly told the religious leaders that he was Messiah. He gave them the clear understanding that he was the Son of God, and they had that chance, that opportunity to accept him as such. And they completely rejected him. In fact, you might remember that after the conversation, they actually ran around the temple complex and picked up rocks, and their desire was to stone Jesus to death as a mob. And by the sovereignty of God, Jesus escaped that, went across the river to another place, and there he stayed from December until the story that we have today, which is approaching April. God's timing was not for Jesus to die in December, and it was not for Jesus to die by stoning. It was for Jesus to die in April at Passover and to die by crucifixion. You know, the Apostle John, as I've mentioned before in his gospel account, only reports 7 miracles. Now, Jesus did many miracles. In fact, at the end of John's gospel, at the end of it, which we'll eventually get to, he says, if I told you all the things Jesus did, the world could not contain the books. We have many miracles recorded in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. John only records 7. Do you happen to remember what the number 7 symbolizes? Symbolizes perfection or completion. And John is showing that Jesus is the perfect Son of God. John also shows 7 I am statements of Jesus, where Jesus uses the name of God. He actually says Yahweh in the original language in the Greek in which the New Testament is written. It's ego imi, I am. And Jesus gives descriptions, predicates that describe what God is like. I am the bread of life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the light of the world. And in our lesson today, we'll have another one of these I am statements. And we will see the very last miracle that John records Jesus doing. It's the last public sign in Jesus' ministry. His last, and by the way, John calls the miracle signs. The signs that point to something. And this is the last one and the greatest one. So let's look at chapter 11, verses 1 through 6. I call a time of friendship. Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary, his sister, Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent to him, saying, Lord, he whom you love is ill. But when Jesus heard it, he said, this illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. I want to begin with verse 5. Jesus loved Martha and Mary and Lazarus. He loved them. You know, Jesus was homeless. When he left Nazareth, he was never really welcome back. Although he went back once and visited there, he was never really welcome back. The scriptures say in another place he had nowhere to lay his head. In other words, Jesus lived pretty much as an itinerant preacher, although he had a place in Capernaum. We don't know where that was. But he was a homeless person, and yet when he came near Jerusalem, he had a home to visit, the home of Lazarus and Mary and Martha. They always were his friends. They always allowed him to stay, allowed his disciples to stay. Let me tell you something. If you have 13 people visit you, that's a crowd. That's a crowd. But Lazarus and Mary and Martha always took Jesus and his disciples in, and they were friends to Jesus. And so when Lazarus gets ill, Martha sends a messenger to Jesus. She sends a messenger to find Jesus. By the way, it's a day's travel from where she is to where he is. It's a day's walk, some 20 miles. And they sends the message, and it doesn't say anything except, Lord, the one you love is sick. In other words, the hidden idea is, I know you'll come because the one you love is sick. And yet, Jesus does something very interesting. He doesn't come right then. In fact, he says when he gets this message, he says to his disciples, this sickness will not end in death. Now, it's interesting because the fact is that when the messenger left to go tell Jesus, Lazarus died. He was dead by the time the messenger got to Jesus. And yet, Jesus said, this sickness will not end in death. It is for the glory of God. Well, what does that mean? Well, that's what the story is going to show. That the death was not a permanent death, and not a final death. This wasn't the end of the story. That's what Jesus was trying to say. Jesus was some 20 miles away from Bethany, and he stays put. Now, it's interesting. Lazarus is described as a good man. He got sick, and he died. Not because there was anything wrong with him spiritually. He just lives in a sin-warped world like we all do. Do you know that good people can get sick? Good people will die. That doesn't mean they're sinful, that they're being punished for some kind of sin. Doesn't mean that junk. We're all part of a sin-warped world. We all are. Bacteria doesn't say, well, he's a Christian, I'll skip him. Lazarus was sick. And so Jesus gets the message. He tells his disciples, this is going to be something greater than Lazarus dying, although by the time he got the message, Lazarus was dead. And then Jesus stays put. He doesn't leave. He doesn't rush away to help his friend or help the sisters. He stays where he is. So let's move on to the story, what I call a time of misunderstanding, verses 7 through 16. Then after this, he said to his disciples, let us go to Judea again. The disciples said to him, Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and you're going there again? Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in a day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. After saying these things, he said to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to waken him. The disciples said to him, Lord, if he's fallen asleep, he will recover. Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought he meant taking rest in sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus has died. And for your sake, I am glad that I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him. So Thomas, called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go, that we may die with him. On the morning of the fourth day, Jesus told his disciples it was time to go visit the family of Martha and Mary. Disciples were aghast. They say, Jesus, you were just in Jerusalem a couple of months ago, and they tried to kill you. And you're heading back in that direction again? Jesus reminded them that he was on a divine timetable. Just like there's light in the daytime, and you can work when there's light in the daytime, Jesus is saying, there's still things for me to do. I'm still operating under my Father's providence here. I still have work to do. It's not over yet. While there's light, there's a chance to do good. So, verse 11, after saying these things, he said, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to wake him up. Hence the sermon title, Wake Up Wonder. And of course, they misunderstood. You know, the word sleep in the Bible is sometimes used to refer to death, and most of the time it refers to actual physical sleep. But occasionally it's a euphemism for dying. And Jesus meant it in that way, that Lazarus had died. But of course, they took it the literal way. All right, if he's falling asleep, he's getting better. He's going to recover, and we ain't got no business heading toward Jerusalem. It's dangerous down there. And then Jesus said, no, our friend. Friend, you've been in the house many times, his house. You've ate his food many times. You've been cared for by him many times. Our friend has died. And I'm going to see the family. And Thomas, you know, we always think of doubting Thomas at the end of the Gospels there. Thomas is a very practical guy. And he's called the twin. Now, the reason for that is that the name Thomas in Hebrew means twin. And the name Thomas in Greek is Didymus. Ditto. I don't know who his twin brother was, somebody. But Thomas is a very practical guy, and he's saying, well, you know, we go back there right now, and 2 months ago they were trying to kill us. All right, we go there, you know, they're going to stone you, and they'll probably get us too. Thomas is pretty pessimistic, but I want you to notice that he's loyal. He says, let us go, we'll die too. He's loyal. I got to give him credit for that. And Jesus and his group begin to get ready to make this 20-mile walk from where they are to Bethany. And so we move on to the story, verses 17 and following. I call a time of sorrow. Now when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Remember, 1 day for the messenger to get to Jesus, 2 days he stayed, 1 day for Jesus to travel back. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off. And many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, but Mary remained seated in the house. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you. The mention of 4 days is significant. According to one of my scholars, D.A. Carson, whose textbook I use in seminary, there was a teaching among the Jewish rabbis that the soul of a deceased person would hover over the body after death for 3 days. The soul would hover over the body, hoping to re-enter it. But as the body began to decay and the face began to become disfigured, it would be impossible, and the soul would then go on to what the Jews call Sheol, the afterlife. Now that's superstition. It's not true, but that's what they thought. And so a body, a corpse that's been dead for 4 days, according to Jewish understanding, is absolutely dead. Decay has begun to set in. Decomposition is going. That person is gone. There's no hope. It is absolutely hopeless. They're not in a coma. They're gone. Now, Lazarus must have been a successful businessman because it says that many of the Jews came from Jerusalem to visit Martha and Mary. And I'm sure that these were business partners and people, customers, and people that Lazarus dealt with. He had to have money. Obviously, they had a big house. He had to have money. He had influence in his community. And so people are coming. They're walking 2 miles to go visit Martha and Mary. And they come to visit. And so the house where Mary and Martha are mourning is pretty crowded with folks. And it's interesting that the Jews had several customs regarding mourning for the dead. There was 7 days of deep mourning, what they call deep mourning. And in those deep mourning, in those days, it was prohibited for the family to anoint themselves with any perfume or ointment. The grieving family would not wear shoes for some strange reason. They were not allowed to conduct any business or study or even take a bath. 7 days. I guess at the end of that, everybody's ready to get wet. Those 7 days were followed by 30 additional days of lighter mourning when they could go about their business, but they were still mourning. And it was expected that every family that could afford it would hire at least 2 flute players who would play mournful tunes and at least 1 wailing woman. And the wailing woman, and in this case, there probably were more than one because this was a wealthy family, their job was to shriek and mourn and make lots of noise describing the grief that everybody was feeling. So it's a noisy house. And it's a crowded house. And it's a house where Martha hears that Jesus is now finally coming 4 days after she sent the messenger. And so she gets up and she runs out to meet Jesus. And when she does, she expresses her sorrow. Look at verse 21. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. You know that's true. Nobody ever died in the presence of Jesus. And she expresses her sorrow. She also kind of saying a little bit of a rebuke. Why weren't you here? We needed you here. And then she goes on to say something of spiritual value, she says, but even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you. Now, is she expecting Jesus to raise her brother from the dead? No. That thought doesn't enter her mind. She's hoping that Jesus can somehow give some comfort to this family. Somehow give some blessing to this family. These are two women now that lost the businessman who was bringing in the money. They're on their own now. And she's thinking, Jesus, I know God will do something if you'll ask Him. But Jesus doesn't offer her comfort. Strangely enough, He offers her a challenge. Let's look at verses 23 and following. I call a time of faith. Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said to Him, I know that He'll rise again in the resurrection on the last day. Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in Me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in Me shall never die." Do you believe this? She said to Him, "Yes, Lord, I believe that You are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world." Physical death is always considered the ultimate enemy. In the New Testament, it's called the last enemy. But Jesus was calling Martha to a deeper truth. He said, "Your brother will rise again." And of course, she immediately thought of what the Pharisees had taught. The rabbis in the synagogues, the Pharisees had always taught that when the Messiah comes, the righteous Jews will be raised up and be able to live in the Messianic kingdom. We ain't worried about those ugly Gentiles, but the righteous Jews, in their thoughts, would be raised up to live under the Messiah in the new kingdom. Martha was saying to Jesus, "Yeah, I know. The Pharisees had taught me in Sabbath school. I know. One day, everybody who's a righteous Jew will be resurrected. I know. I'll eventually, way down the road, I'll see Him then." Jesus said, in essence, "I ain't talking about then." I'm paraphrasing. I'm talking about now. You see, Martha was looking distant future, and the friends of the house were consoling the family over the recent past, and Jesus is talking about the immediate present. Jesus says some important things. He says, "I am the resurrection." Here's one of the I am statements of Jesus. One of the seven statements that uses the name of God. We don't see it in the English, but Yahweh in the Hebrew, ego imai in the Greek. I am. I am the name of God. I am. You want to see God? I am God. I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in Me, though he die, yet shall he live. And all those who believe in Me shall never die. Now, what does He mean by that? He doesn't mean he's not saying they won't die physically. His friend's already dead. It means they won't die eternally. They won't die permanently. They have life that goes beyond the grave. They have a future with God that is a forever future. Our soul doesn't end when the body decays. Jesus is saying, I am the life. Jesus challenged Martha to go past her discouragement and past her sadness and to put her faith in Him personally. And to her credit, Martha looked into the eyes of Jesus with tears of sorrow in her eyes, and she reached out in faith and made a proclamation. I mean, a really great proclamation. Verse 27, Martha said to Him, "Yes, Lord, I believe that You are the Christ, Messiah, the Son of God who is coming into the world." She uses three terms to describe Jesus: Lord, Christ, and Son of God. She's showing great faith. And little did she know that her faith was about to be rewarded. Let's move on to verses 28 and following. I call a time of emotion. When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, "The teacher is here and is calling for you." And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to Him. Now Jesus was not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met Him. When the Jews who were with her in the house, consoling her, saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now, when Mary came to Jesus, to where Jesus was, and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" They said, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. So the Jews said, "See how much he loved him?" But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of a blind man also have kept this man from dying?" Now, we don't have the whole conversation. You know, the Bible is always a Reader's Digest version of what happened. It's always a condensed version of what took place. But apparently, when Jesus talked with Martha, he asked Martha to go get Mary. And apparently, Jesus wanted to speak to Martha and Mary in private, consoling the sisters privately. Mary gets the message from her sister, and she gets up and runs out to meet Jesus. But unfortunately, everybody else gets up too, and they follow her. So much for privacy. And when Mary got to Jesus, she fell at his feet. It's interesting that Mary is presented three times in the New Testament, and all three times she's at the feet of Jesus. That's the best place to be. So she got to Jesus, and she says the same thing her sister said. She said, "Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died." And that must be because Martha and Mary have been saying that to each other over and over again over the last 4 days. "If Jesus had been here, our brother would still be alive." And she says that to Jesus. She says the same thing. And then the whole group shows up. All the mourning people come in. All the mourning women with their shrieking and wailing come in. Maybe the flute players come in. I don't know. And all these sad faces show up. There's crying and there's shrieking. And in the Greek, when it talks about their mourning, it's talking about loud mourning. Oh! I mean, they're making noise. Jesus was moved emotionally at the scene. I study 7 versions of the Bible each week. 7 different translations. Every one of them tries to kind of make this as best they can. You know what this says when it says Jesus was deeply moved in his spirit? It means he was angry. It's a Greek word that when it's used, it actually comes from horses. It means the snorting of a horse. When it's used to people, it represents anger or indignation. Jesus is angry. This is what it means. Well, what's he angry at? Well, maybe the fact that everybody's acting like there's no hope, people haven't been listening to him, that with him there's always hope. Maybe that lack of belief, maybe that lack of faith may be part of it. But I think the main reason Jesus is angry is Jesus is experiencing what sin has done to the human race. What sin has done to the human race. I don't mean that Lazarus did some sin. No. Sin has done to the human race. The what happens, sin brings death. You remember the Bible passage, the wages of sin is death? The outcome of sin is death. What sin has done to the human race. It was never God's will. Jesus is angry at that. Deeply moved is the English way of saying it. And so he asks, "Where have you laid him?" They say, "Lord, come and see." And as they walk toward that tomb, shortest verse in the Bible appears. Jesus wept. And the word there in Greek is a word that means burst in tears quietly. A quiet burst of tears. It's not the same word as the wailing and moaning of the other people. It's a quiet burst of tears. It's like you can't hold back the tears. You ever felt that way? Just can't hold back the tears? Did you know that that verse occurs at the death of a friend? At the death of a friend. Jesus was human. He was human. And we don't understand how God managed to do that, that Jesus had a divine side and a human side that were together, and he was both human and God at the same time, and we can't comprehend how that could be. Jesus was human. You know, the prophet Isaiah had written about the Messiah that he would be a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. Well, that day Jesus was acquainted with grief. And you know it's okay for us to cry at the death of a loved one? Jesus did that. It's okay to do that. Jesus did that himself. Well, the writer of Hebrews declared, we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses. He does because he knows what it's like to be human. King David wrote in the Psalms, the Lord shows compassion on those who fear him, for he knows our frame. He remembers that we are dust. Jesus understands us. Jesus understands us. Well, as Jesus cried those quiet tears as they walked toward the tomb, those Jewish people who'd come from Jerusalem who were there to console Mary and Martha, they noticed that. And some of them said, well, see how much he loved him. Isn't that sweet? How much he loved Lazarus. He's just like us. But there was some of the crowd that says, well, wait a minute. It's supposed to be the miracle worker. This guy we've been hearing about that's doing all these miracles around the countryside. He's the one that healed the blind man in Jerusalem a few months ago. If he has that power, why couldn't he have stopped this man from dying? See, they have kind of a negative reaction to him. Just like it always happens that Jesus is either believed in or rejected. Well, we move on to the climax of the story, a time of authority. Verses 38 and following. Then Jesus, deeply moved again, emotionally disturbed. In other words, I don't mean mentally. I mean just this upset him. Came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, take away the stone. Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, Lord, by now there'll be an odor. For he's been dead 4 days. Jesus said to her, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they took away the stone. And Jesus lifted up his eyes. And he prays a prayer and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me. But I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me. When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out! The man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips, and his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, unbind him and let him go. The whole group came to the cave. It was a family tomb. Remember, this family had money. So they built a family tomb, and those tombs would be oftentimes hewn out of a hillside, or in this case, a cave. There would always be an entrance and then a chamber. And in the chamber, they would have cut out shelves on each side, usually 4 on each side, so a total of 8 shelves in which they would place the bodies. Now, I get this from D.A. Carson, my textbook writer from seminary. When a body was prepared to be laid, the corpse was laid on a sheet of linen wide enough to envelop the body completely and more than twice the length of the corpse. In other words, wide and long sheet of linen. Then the sheet was drawn over the head and back down to the feet. The Jews did not do what the Egyptians did. They didn't make mummies out of them, but they did wrap them up. The feet were bound at the ankles with linen strips, and then the arms were put together and they were bound with linen strips. The face was bound with another cloth, and then strips of linen were added around and around the body, often with spices that would serve as glue, basically, and keep everything together, and would also have to keep the smell of decay down. The spices would serve to kind of overcome the stench that would invariably appear. You see, Jews did not embalm bodies. They buried people the same day they died. And so this is what happened to Lazarus. This corpse has a long sheet over him, linen strips all around him with spices that have now dried, glued things together, a face cloth that's now glued on, and he's there in that cave, in that tomb. Jesus tells the sisters, take away the stone. And Martha immediately reacts. She said, wait a minute, I know you'd love to see the body, but that's a bad idea, Lord. That's a bad idea. He's been dead 4 days. The decomposition set in. You know, Lord, he stinks. I just have to say it that way. Lord, he stinks. We don't want this. And Jesus turns to her and he says, do you remember what I told you? And what he says to her, we don't have recorded in Scripture. It's one of those parts of the conversation we don't have recorded. But apparently he had told her in the conversation, if you'll just believe, you'll see the glory of God displayed today. He said, I want to remind you what I told you. And so, I guess probably reluctantly, Martha told the men who were her servants, all right, guys, move the stone away. And you know how it is. This is a big old stone that's held up against the cave to keep out animals, keep the animals getting into to the corpses. And so they start rolling that stone around, still rolling it away from the entrance to the cave. Jesus lifts his eyes to heaven and prays. He stood in the traditional Jewish posture of prayer, standing upright with his arms out and his palms facing toward heaven. And he looks up with his head and he prays this prayer. And he says, Lord, I thank you that you heard me. I know you always do. But I'm saying it out loud so the people understand that this is your situation, that you're in charge, you're in authority, and I'm here as your son. And then he looks at the tomb. And I bet everybody was looking at the tomb and looking at Jesus and looking at the tomb and looking at Jesus. What's going to happen now? And Jesus cries out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. Somebody said that if Jesus hadn't used the name of Lazarus, that every dead person in the countryside would have come out. And Lazarus starts hopping out. Remember, his ankles are bound. He can't walk. He's bound. He hops his way out. And all of a sudden, this wrapped up figure that's been dead 4 days hops up to the entrance of the tomb, and everybody in that crowd is aghast. They're flabbergasted. What? Everybody is stunned. Can you imagine the excitement? And Jesus said, unwrap him. Let him go. This man doesn't need grave clothes anymore. He's for grace clothes now. Well, that must have been an incredible scene. People were absolutely flabbergasted and stunned. You see, in the Gospels, Jesus, there are two instances where Jesus has raised somebody from the dead. Two other instances. There's the widow of Nain, and there's another instance where Jesus raised somebody from the dead. But in those cases, they were in the funeral on the way to the tomb. They'd only be dead a few hours. This is a man that's been dead 4 days. Remember, after 3 days, there ain't no chance. That was the reason why Jesus stayed where he was, so that it would be obvious that this was an impossible. This was impossible to have happen. This was impossible to do. That was the point. That was it. And so I guess the guys ran up and they began unwrapping Lazarus' face. And they pulled that face cloth off. He had a big old grin on his face. Y'all never guess what I got to see in heaven. And so everyone is stunned. You'd think that there'd be a revival. Everybody get right with the Lord right then and there. That's not exactly what happened. So let's look at the anticlimax to the story. Verses 45 and following, I call a time of rejection. Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council together and said, what are we to do? For this man performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, you know nothing at all, nor do you understand that it's better for you that one man should die for the people, not the whole nation should perish. He did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation. And not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who were scattered abroad. So, from that day on, they made plans to put him to death. Jesus, therefore, no longer walked openly among the Jews, but went from there to the region near the wilderness, to a town called Ephraim. There he stayed with the disciples. After this fantastic miracle in the afternoon of the fourth day, many of the Jews who had come from Jerusalem to console Mary and Martha on the death of Lazarus, who saw this miracle with their own eyes, many of them believed in Jesus. How could they not? It's the greatest miracle recorded in the New Testament before Jesus on resurrection. But there was a segment of them that were not believers. They just became informers. And they went back in Jerusalem, talked to the Pharisees, and told the rabbis what Jesus had done. And the rabbis got hold of the priests and said, "We got to get the whole council together, the Sanhedrin. We got to get them all together." And so they did. And they talked about, what are we going to do now? While the whole nation will believe that Jesus is Messiah. And if the Romans hear about this, they'll think that there's an uprising in the land. And the Romans will send a whole legion down from Caesarea. And they will scatter our people. They'll capture our city completely. And they'll destroy our teacher, our building, our temple. And we'll be out of a job. Pretty self-centered. And yet the high priest, by the way, when it says the high priest that year, it doesn't mean that he was only high priest for a year. Caiaphas was actually high priest for 18 years. But he was the high priest that special year, that remarkable year. And the high priest responds kind of indignantly and says, "You boys don't know what you're talking about. Y'all worried about this. Y'all upset, confused. It's a simple solution. We got to get rid of him. We got to kill him. Get him out of the picture. It's better for one man to die for the people than the whole people be destroyed." Now, he didn't realize it when he said it, because what he means is get rid of Jesus. But God's Spirit prompted him to say it in a specific way. It's better for one man to die for the people. Do you realize that's exactly what Jesus did? He died for the people. For the people. The Apostle John recognizes that fact, that the Holy Spirit prompted this high priest who is not following God at all to say the right thing. Well, the council at that point decides our option is plan A, kill Jesus. That's what we've got to manage to do. We've got to find a way to do it. Interesting that this miracle of raising one man from the dead would actually force the issue by which Jesus would die. And he knew it. He knew it when he went to Bethany. He knew it when he performed this miracle. He knew this would happen. As he gave this man, Lazarus, additional earthly life, the result would be that he would give up his own life. That was the Father's sovereign plan. Jesus knew it. And so at this point, Jesus and his disciples, they move out toward the desert. And they stay in the wilderness until April, when Passover will come around, and Jesus will return back, and he'll come back to Jerusalem on what we call Palm Sunday. He had shown very clearly to anybody willing to believe that he is the Messiah, the Son of God, that he has authority over all things, authority over life itself. He is the resurrection and the life. And by believing in him, there is life. There is eternal life. That's as true just as much now as it was then. So the question always is, are we going to be in the group that believes or in the group that rejects? Either one. There's always a choice. Let's bow.